Welcome to the Influential Women Podcast, the podcast where we chat to some amazing and inspiring women. This is Nikki Bannerman, and my influential woman today is Dr. Nigat Arif. Thank you so much and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Nikki.
Oh, pleasure. It's lovely to talk to you. Dr. Nigat Arif is a family expert GP specialising in women's health, a medical educator in family planning, and a health, wellbeing and inclusion speaker, including appearing on BBC Breakfast Radio, BBC Look East and This Morning TV, and an award winner for medical causes. Wow, look at all the things that you're doing. But how are you doing in this crazy world?
I'm doing okay, considering. And they always say that, I don't know if you've read The Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, when it says it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And I think COVID feels like that. It feels like, for us personally, and dare I say it, lockdown has not been too bad. But at the same time, as a clinician, it has been the worst of time, because the number of sick people I'm seeing, the loss of life, people being affected, their livelihoods, their businesses being affected, people ending up going to food banks, or I've got a family who are struggling to make ends meet. And I think it's been that perfect storm where we've got fear about our health, fear about our livelihoods, and then the uncertainty of what's happening around the world at the same time. And so that has been the perfect concoction of impacting our mental health, which I've seen far more as a GP. But then at the same time, people have found a real innovative ways of finding new things, like myself. I never thought I would be doing broadcasting until the pandemic hit. So yeah. I never did TV very much at all. Never did TikTok before.
Yes, I know, that's amazing.
Never worked with medical education about vaccines and pandemic, and my work with the UN has just got bigger and bigger in regards to that. And never would have met you, Nikki.
Yes, exactly. Oh, it's lovely to meet you. And gosh, you really are in the front line, aren't you, in terms of everyone's outpouring their grief and their troubles and everything to you. And that must bring you down in terms of, you know, mental health. I think everybody literally has been touched with mental health like they've never been before. You know, I'm an optimist myself, and it's really, really difficult to be an optimist. And that makes you struggle with who you are as well. There's all sorts of things that are being churned up, aren't they, in people? People are in turmoil. But they're also, as you say, they're finding the positive. They're thinking, okay, we don't know how long we've got on this world. Everything's out of control. We're all very afraid. What can we do? Should we move to the country, go to the sea, go on holiday, do whatever we've never done before, tell people we love them? You know, it's really, really strange, isn't it? But does anyone ever ask you how you are? Doctors, you know, you spend your life looking after everyone else in such a selfless way. Does anyone say, actually, Dr. Nigat, how are you really feeling? Are you okay?
Do you know, this is the thing I found a lot doing breakfast TV, so BBC Breakfast, because I'm very honest and my face is such an expression face. I can't hide my emotions at all. So I always say I'd be horrible at poker. But people on social media are asking, and I think that's because we are opening up the conversation of mental health, and so it's not a taboo so much. At work, I would say, because we are literally in the firing line, and I use air quotation marks for that, it is so full on that sometimes I don't even get to go have a toilet break until about 6:30 in the evening, because I'm just bang, 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 going through all the triage calls. The biggest issue is that in general practice, we have a huge problem with work staff in regards to sickness, mental health impacting us. We're getting burnout amongst colleagues. And colleagues are leaving the profession. So workforce is our biggest issues within the NHS. Yeah. So in our local area, we've had 3 GPs leave, and there's no prospective plan to get those individuals their places booked, because there aren't any locally for us.
No one's trained.
We have I live in Buckinghamshire. It's a very leafy, lovely place. But it is the village, and not many people want to come to the countryside sometimes. Mm. They want to be in the hustle and bustle of the city. So we are then trying to manage when other colleagues are off at the same time. So the pressure is immense.
Overwhelmed, yes.
We've had no let up because on top of our everyday work as GPs, we've had the vaccination program, which is wonderful. I mean, I'm a huge advocate for vaccines, but it's work again. We've had the flu vaccine, children being vaccinated, test and trace happening because people are being sick. And then we've got to look at how much PPE we've got, resources within the NHS. And amongst all of that, as GPs, we are, because we're generalists, we're not specialists in anything, that we're trying to manage the rest of the services, because the first port of call for any patient, whether it be their social situation, their mum has dementia, their child has bronchiosis, they've got COPD, or their high blood pressure is not being controlled, or their husband has had a stroke.
Yes.
The first port of call is always, I'll pick up the phone to the GP.
Yes.
And then
now you
overnight,
can't visit them. It's a video now, isn't it? Which is so surreal.
Exactly.
To explain how you're ill.
So overnight, what happened was, and it came as a surprise to all of us, is that we've reverted to telephone consultations because we had to keep the healthcare staff safe, because the nature of our job is, I pick up everything from my patients.
Yes, you must do. But you also must have a good immunity as well. You've seen it all. And also people must have post-traumatic stress, have they, by now? Because having that survival cannot simply last for 2 years, can it, in terms of that survival? It has to go into, actually, this is a huge trauma.
I'm seeing that a lot in my colleagues who have actually been dealing with patients in ITU. So remember, doctors come to see doctors. So yes. My patients are nurses and doctors and healthcare professionals as
yes.
well. So what I'm seeing is, in regards to that aspect, yes, we are. And I'm seeing then burnout in my colleagues. Because remember, in the midst of all of this, as healthcare professionals, it's very easy to forget that we are humans. I have a family. I have a husband. I have kids that I need to get to school to. And we're all like that. We all have families. And so as well as managing the pressure at work and the stress, and we're seeing sometimes the finity of life, you understand that life is finite. Yes. And life is short, and young people have passed away from COVID. It's hard to detach yourself. So I think this is unfortunately a highlight of the infrastructure being at difficulty before the pandemic started.
Yes.
And then in the pandemic, we've just been buckling and buckling. But I do have hope that I think the changes that will come about are actually for good, because it's preservation.
Yes, will help save time in the future. And the NHS has been incredible.
It has. And I have seen far more people being engaged with their healthcare now. So I will actively get young people in their 30s going, oh, but what can I do so I don't have an underlying health condition? Because everybody now
really?
Understands what that
yes,
means.
Yes, of course.
What can I do so I don't get high blood pressure? What, you know, NHS health checks can I do? How
really?
Can I keep my weight down? And I
yes.
think now there's a renaissance in our aspect of actually thinking about quality of life,
yes,
rather than
awareness.
Just the quantity and having longer years, but actually thinking, how can I live healthier and better now in my
yes,
younger years
to so save I can themselves invest for the future? No, I think my teens are the same, you know, very into nutrition and fitness and health and wanting to protect themselves, yes, for the future. Amazing. Now, I know you've been helping educate the world with your incredible TikTok, which you've got into as well in lockdown, have you? 169,000 views. I mean, that's unbelievable. That makes you so cool, especially for your young children. Where, I don't know if they are aware. Humour, and I think you were singing, or was that miming?
169 followers.
169,000 followers.
And 1.3 million views. And I think some of my TikToks have hit over a million views. And the weird thing is, Nikki, is that it was a lockdown project. Like, lots of people started as a lockdown project.
Yes.
And my background is, although I'm a generalist, and my specialism is women's health.
Yes.
And I speak to a lot of women who, for whom English is not their first language, and Pakistani women and Muslim women. And when it comes to women's health, like talking about periods, talking about, you know, painful sex, menopause, it's such a taboo area that I have always found it fascinating, because it affects every woman. Like, every woman will have a period who has a womb. And yet we will hush hush it, and it's under the veil. And we I come from a culture where it seems a part of it's attached to shame very quickly. You don't talk about your breasts or having to examine your breasts because it's shameful to talk about your breasts. Or you don't talk about the fact that you're having hot flushes. You don't talk about the fact that fertility might be affected. So we live in this sort of entity within my community where we don't talk about things, but yet they are really physical aspects. And when a woman goes to see the NHS GP, they don't really understand the Asian context of the conversation. And unfortunately, a lot of, as we know, women's healthcare is problematic within the UK, and menopausal care is not mandatory training for all healthcare professionals in the UK. So I thought, do you know what? I'm going to use my time and make TikToks about women's health.
And
my
fun.
sister goes, who's going to want to watch TikToks about hormone replacement therapy and vaginal dryness?
I was watching it literally yesterday. Well, the first one, not the second one. Common influencer. He must be one of the only medics out there just changing the way that people view medicine. I think it's brilliant. I think it's sort of taken us all into that. I think they call it high functioning anxiety, don't they? And people are just feeling. And how can we help people? Are there any sort of quick, fast tips that we can say, as if we'd say to children or whatever, how we can feel better about ourselves?
When it comes to mood related things, my first instinct thing, and it's always talk to people, tell people how you're feeling, because our brain talks to us the most, and our brain can actually be really cruel to us. More crueler than anybody else around you, actually. And we forget that sometimes. And there was a lot about self-care. And self-care isn't just, go into a bubble bath and that's your self-care. But self-care is actually how you talk to yourself first, how you feel, what fuel you give your body, so how you feed yourself. So is it alcohol? Is it drugs? Is it smoke? So look at all of the other things that might be impacting your mental health and impacting your low mood. Firstly, always talk, because a problem shared is a problem halved. And I know that sounds really corny, but it is so true.
Mm. And for men too.
Yeah, for men too. At times when you feel overwhelmed, I always say to do something called box breathing. So your breathing can really center you and calm you. So for example, what you do is you take a deep breath in through your nose or your mouth, hold for up to, 4 to 5 seconds, and then breathe it out again. And then deep breath in again. And deep breath out. And that has proven, lots of studies have shown, just good breathing exercises, mindfulness and meditation can bring down your heart rate, can lower your blood pressure, lower your feelings of being overwhelmed and anxiety. And I think we forget to do that.
Yes,
that we can,
brilliant.
We can just center ourselves. And then obviously, if you are really struggling with your mental health, then you must speak to the doctor. Now, the NHS has done so much things over the pandemic. So they've brought out apps. So there's the One You app, there's Every Mind Matters as well, which are free NHS resources to look cognitive behavioural therapy. And now you don't have to see the doctor to get a referral to speak to a counsellor or referral for psychological therapies. You can go onto the NHS website and type in IAPT, so IAPT. So that's your psychological therapies in your local area. Put your postcode in and you can self-refer. And bypass the system, because we are trying to get the speed of referrals better.
Yes, of course.
And get people
that's what people need.
The problem we have, as I said at the beginning, is workforce. So we've got, it has to be manned by humans.
Yes, and you're one of those as well, aren't you, doing everything else 24/7.
And so I always say to people, bear with us, but please just always talk, and please just refer yourself to psychological therapies, because it might be a wait, but at least you're in the system in the NHS to get support. We need to do better, but we're getting there.
Definitely. And there's no sort of stigma associated with it on people's medical records now. It's just people need to talk, people need to work through the issues, and there's help available, because that will help a load of people listening, because people are probably even worried about that, worried that they'll have a sort of a mental health issue on their medical records, but they won't, will they? It's just a support system.
I think it's up to us, and this is why I say the pandemic has also come with the best of times.
Yes.
You mentioned Dr. Alex there earlier, and he's posting that his medication, his sertraline that he's taking, to take away even the stigma of medication, to take away the stigma of therapy as well, because it used to be seen as, oh, you're seeing a therapist and it's a happy clappy time. But actually it's not like that at all. And we don't even stigmatize against mental health. I always say to people that you cannot think of the brain as a separate entity from your body. If you had a broken ankle, you wouldn't walk around on that for a year, would you? You'd always get treatment. We seem to think that the brain is a separate bit of us.
Yes, or we're embarrassed, you know.
Exactly. The brain is a physical organ that we have. And if that ends up having some problems with it, or your thought processes are a little bit different, your sleep patterns are different. Women who are going through the menopause, because their hormones are fluctuating, they get menopausal psychological symptoms. We can treat that. Please don't put up with it.
Yes, that's really helpful, actually, doctor, because, you know, children are better at this, aren't they, in terms of they live for today, they focus on their own priorities and, you know, what's important to them. And they're quite hopeful. And I think adults are really sort of a bit floundering around a bit at the moment, aren't they, in terms of what is my priority? What should I be doing? You know, how am I feeling? Living too much in our heads, as you say, that negative self-chatter. I interviewed somebody in a previous interview that said they call it mean girling. And I think that's so true. It's like we are horrible to ourselves and expect ourselves to be perfect at everything, particularly women. And it's just not possible, is it? And I heard a trauma counsellor I interviewed actually before, she said we've all gone back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs in terms of that just wanting safety and food and warmth and those basic values are the only things that we're sort of really craving to nurture ourselves, aren't they? So have you learned anything about yourself in lockdown? I mean, you've obviously learned that you've thrown yourself into broadcasting, which you never imagined. Resident doctor on BBC Breakfast, based in Buckinghamshire, mother of three. Big clap to you all, you know, and the NHS, because I don't know how you do it all. But you found out that you like communicating this way. You've got a platform, haven't you?
Like I said, these are happy accidents. In 2019, I was on maternity leave and I wrote a post about menopause and women's health in the Asian community, because my father is an imam and we converse a lot with the women in my community, because obviously that is the hub of our community. And women were saying to me, oh, but I'm getting all these symptoms, our hot flushes. And the first thing that they were getting was antidepressants, or they were being diagnosed as fibromyalgia. And I said, but this is perimenopause that they're going through. So I put a little tweet out saying, are other doctors, it was really for other doctors to say, are other doctors seeing that the symptoms are slightly different for Asian women? Because most of women's health is so encapsulated as a Western conversation. And I wasn't really getting to grasp with what Asian women or women of colour, what their experiences are. BBC Breakfast at the time were doing Wake Up to the Menopause with Louise Minchin. I think that was breaking open the can, as they say, and just allowing women to talk about and breaking the taboo around it. And they said to come have a discussion about it, because we'd love to know your experiences as a doctor working with ethnic minority communities.
Oh, as an expert, yeah.
I did a 6-minute stint on the sofa, spoke a bit of Punjabi in the middle of it, chatted about vagina dryness, came off the sofa at 8:30, rang my mum and said, Mum, will you eat? I was on national telly, never done telly. And do you know what? My mother being my mother, and I think lots of women and men might be able to identify this, she just said to me, your hijab was not correct.
Oh, so she was, I won't talk about the rude stuff. But you were nominated for the Bevan Prize for Health and Wellbeing for exceptional commitment to advance wellbeing in your community. And as you say, you speak fluently in Urdu and Punjabi, and just, you know, brings a great deal of trust and respect from your community. And that's helping women that don't normally reach out, as you say. Amazing.
Well, I think that the thing is that women like me, who look like me, wearing a hijab, and I dress very modestly, we're not seen on TV. I never saw anybody who looked like me on TV. And it's only now that you realise the value of that, because, and we've seen that time and over again, you know, ethnic minority communities are very suspicious of the vaccine programme, very suspicious of the pandemic and what COVID means and all these restrictions. And the reason is if you look at it, we never really represented. So if you look at all the COVID posters and the propaganda that was coming out from Public Health England, it was always a very middle-class white family washing their hands, a very middle-class white person wearing a mask, a woman, you know. I sat in my surgery when I was a junior doctor in Slough, very high South Asian population, Sikh and Hindu population, Muslim population in Slough. And I looked at all the posters in the waiting room, and it's a white middle-class woman checking through and then remembering she needs a cervical smear test, or it's a white gentleman doing a finger prick test for diabetes. So I thought to myself, if I've got an Asian man sitting in my, how does he know any of that health information is targeted to him?
Yes.
And actually, to our peril, we realize that you mimic what you see. So if you see someone doing something who looks like you, that is far more powerful. I'm really aware now of that because I've got three boys. I've got a 3-year-old, a 6-year-old and a 10-year-old. And they are very keen to find characters that look like themselves. You know, person of colour is like, oh my gosh. My first reckoning of someone who looked like me was Naga Minchetti, when I thought somebody who looked like me satting on breakfast TV and just doing a kick-ass job, or Nadia from Bake Off wearing a hijab. For once, women weren't seeing a huge amount of suspicion. You know, I've had some terrible Islamophobia. And I think that this sort of recognizing that I need to represent my own community. So the reason I keep doing it, despite all the abuse sometimes I get, is because there is nobody that looks like me on TV. So I am very aware that people stop. So Middle England suddenly woke up to the fact that actually a woman who wears a hijab isn't suppressed, depressed and repressed. She can't. Gosh. She doesn't need to be sitting in her kitchen baking. Well, I am in my kitchen a lot of the time,
and you are at the moment. But yes, but you're broadcasting.
But she's broadcasting. She's talking about COVID. She's a doctor
and very bright and supportive.
The broadcasting sort of field has come with a massive, almost a huge learning curve for me, because what I thought I was doing, a few TikToks in my kitchen in my house with my kids and dicking about talking about Marina Coyles, actually was being viewed and women by millions, and women who wear hijabs who are Muslim suddenly felt, actually this is not something I'm going to be ashamed about and talk about.
And you've become an inclusive speaker, and you know, which is brilliant that you're representing and helping so many women.
The value of that, I think, with everything is far more important. If you look at the pandemic, the Black Lives Matters, I mean, people of color really want to be seen and recognized across all platforms. Marcus Rashford talking about school meals, you know, Sir Captain Tom Moore, who's a local to us, and him just doing simple acts of just walking, and it cut through race, color, gender, showing that age is not a limiting factor to what you can.
Oh no, everyone loved him. He was what kept everyone going right at the beginning in lockdown one, I think, wasn't it?
So what I always say is that what I've learned about myself in this time is I've had to let go of my fear a lot. And I'm scared a lot of the time. Broadcasting is very scary because it's live, trying to recognize the mood of my patients at the surgery and the public. You know, it's been toing and froing, and the messages have been mixed, masks, no masks. Now you've got to have a booster vaccine as well. So this uncertainty is something that I'm trying to relay to the public.
Yes.
And it's scary. I've really had to learn to control my fear. But I'll tell you a trick, actually, so the listeners might now be able to watch me when I do it, is that the more scared I am, the more I smile. I'm quite a smiley person.
Yes.
But usually, because it's live broadcasting and I'm not always sure what, you know, Dan or Sally will throw at me, or Phil and Holly might ask me on this morning, my smile just gets bigger. So that used to put off a lot of people.
No, but that's brilliant to know, because actually, you know, this podcast is chatting to women about their work, their life, their mantras, but any adversity they've overcome. And to hear someone like you, that everyone thinks a doctor's sussed it, they know everything, they can sort out the world, they can sort themselves out, to know that you're scared too, and you're scared because it's all new to you. People forget that you're human too. You know, you're still a mother of three very young children. You're still helping everyone on all these charities and everything else. And actually, it's scary for you too, because it's new. You don't necessarily know all the answers, but you're helping everyone that you can, which is amazing. So I think that helps other people, because, you know, we're all struggling, and I think you're cutting through an awful lot and reaching an awful lot of people. You're certainly no fool, a qualified expert. What would you say to others who are struggling and unable to cope right now, you know, with the adversity you've been through and come back from, however small or large in their life their adversity is, how to just change their work-life balance and come back from something?
So adversity can be, as you say, small or little. I talk about my smile a lot, and usually I get criticized for smiling because I think people like to see doctors on telly quite serious and stern, and I'm quite a naturally smiley person. But I did lose my smile in 2015. My son needed a liver transplant, And so now that you see me quite open and bubbly and an optimist, but actually for 3 years, it was just the darkest of times. He's now six. We had a four-year-old at the time, and we decided, as any family does, we're young, me and my husband. My husband's a solicitor, and we thought we're going to expand our family and have another child. You know, planned baby, really excited, completely normal pregnancy. But when he was about 3 weeks old, he became yellow. And I had lots of colleagues, doctor colleagues, who'd come to my house and visit him and things. And I said to them, do you know, I don't know whether I'm just exhausted because I'm mum to two now. I've got a four-year-old as well, and I'm breastfeeding. But he looks yellow to me. And they were like, don't worry, Nagat, it's breast milk jaundice. It's fine. This happens to a lot of babies and it's normal. But that gut instinct as a mother and as a doctor kicks in. Yes. At some point. Suddenly his urine was very dark in the nappy and his poo was becoming very pale. And I thought, oh gosh, I think his liver is really struggling. So I took him to the surgery, got a blood test organized. And that evening I got a phone call from the hospital saying, we're going to book an ambulance for you. Your son's clotting is his INR. So it's a marker that we use for how thin the blood is 7.8. Please don't, you know, drop your child because he will bleed heavily. And I was like, went to King's College Hospital, had a huge amount of tests. I stayed there for about 5 days because we couldn't work out what was going on with his liver. And then Professor Thompson called us to his office and said, you know, I know you're a doctor, but I'm going to talk to you as if you're mum. So you need to switch off being a doctor. But your child has a very rare condition called bile salt export protein pump deficiency. So basically can't get rid of his bile salts in his liver. Although he's a baby, his liver is becoming extremely damaged.
Oh my goodness.
He'll have 50% chance of getting liver cancer. But the only treatment for this is to have a liver transplant. And honestly, my world broke apart.
Oh, I'm not surprised.
I think devastation is the word that encapsulated it, because it's weird because I'm such a doctor, I'm such a medic, and I love medicine so much. But I was thinking, oh my goodness, how are we going to get a liver transplant? And then we were told, you know, being from an ethnic minority community, you have to wait longer on the transplant list.
Oh,
because Asian people don't donate. So donation is something that we don't, there's very lack of awareness in our communities. And so I came home, and I come from a community, a very close-knit Muslim community, and you just hush up. You don't air your dirty laundry. You don't talk to anybody about it. The sort of mantra from everybody around me was, oh, just tell them that it's breast milk jaundice. So I hid it and I didn't talk to anybody. And that wait on the transplant list, because 1 in 5 people die waiting on the transplant list. I mean, this is how horrific it is. And that's why I do a lot of work for organ donation awareness now. And he collapsed at home, took him to hospital, and they said, look, if we don't find a transplant or a donor for him, he will die. So we haven't found a match. And I was a match, so I was going to donate.
Oh my goodness.
Then within, I was prepped for theatre. I'd consented everything. I'm talking
really?
About do not resuscitate. Yeah, I was talking about, you know, do not resuscitate, because they also told me the statistics. Live person to live person donation comes with its risks. You have to take half of your liver.
Oh,
and because they don't do them that many in this country, they said, you've got 1 in 200 chance of death. So I'm talking to my husband about how I want my funeral to be.
Oh,
because
gosh.
I just had this need to keep my son alive.
Yes. Yes,
your mother instinct comes in,
isn't it, with your...
And at 3 o'clock in the morning, so I was meant to go down to theatre at 8 with my son. At 3 o'clock in the morning, we got a phone call saying, we've found a match for your son.
Oh my goodness.
It's a liver. It's up in Leeds. We're going to send a helicopter up to Leeds. We're going to get it. It's universal. We're going to have to make sure that your son has this blood transfusion so he can receive the liver and not reject it later on. And then for about 3 years, I think I just walked, like I was asleep. I was working at the same time once he was a little bit better, but we had sepsis after sepsis, problems with his transplant, infections, collections, drains that I came home with, a Hickman line that I tried to
look after. Gosh, you've been through so much.
And so I lost my smile for about 3 years. And that adversity, I think, taught me a couple of things. One is that when I got him home, and it was about 6 months later, I was just randomly washing my dishes and I couldn't stop crying, because I didn't cry throughout all this period. I'm the doctor of the family. I'm the only medic. There's nobody else who's a medic. And so it was always like, let's ask Nagat, you know. And I just, there's this, I just feel that there's this sort of weight on my shoulder sometimes. It's like the Titanic. When the captain of the Titanic ship panicked, that's when everybody panics.
Yes. Oh,
and that's the kind of analogy that we have in our home. When I panic, then everybody falls apart. So I just felt I've got to keep absolutely strong. After 6 months, he's well, he's at home. And that was it. I just stopped crying because it,
bless you,
the relief. And it hit me that, oh my God, the thing that I'm not even talking about, and I'm always saying to people, talk about your problems, this sort of trauma that we've gone through, my community are never going to learn from this. But there's a woman, there's a mother in Leeds who lost her child, because we realized, they told us a little bit, that it was a little boy who was on his bike, fell off and hit the back of his neck and had a brainstem injury and died.
Oh my God.
And his parents saved 8 other people with the donation of their child. And I just thought, these incredible parents who've lost their child were able to do this actual thing of saving my son's life. And I managed to bring my son home.
Yes.
They weren't able to bring their son home at all. And amazing. I can't even flip and talk about it and say to people, look, there's, you never think you need an organ donation, but you do, because you never thought we'd be those people.
And saved your life as well. Amazing.
Saved your life. Yes. So when it comes to adversity, think of how you can actually make that better for other people and for yourself. So I found far more comfort and solace through education, because I'm trying to raise awareness in my community. So talking really helped. I got therapy. I spoke because I had a lot of post-traumatic stress, because
of course
seeing my child going to theatres all the time, never knowing if I'm going to see him after theatres and not knowing if I'm going to bring him home.
Yes.
That built up and built up, and I really became really anxious over his health. And so I had some therapy through that. So as a doctor, I'm happy to admit that I've had therapy. I'm not ashamed about it at all. And then worked with groups and tried to help other parents who are still waiting for transplants and education.
I so see you do that.
Never, just always know that adversity is short-lived. It's for a finite period. It might not feel like it when you're in that adversity, but I promise you that if anything that my son has taught me is that there are happier times at the other end. And it all comes back to is what you do with that adversity. Use it to teach others. You know, they say, let others light their candle in your knowledge, and allow that, because if everybody keeps lighting their candles, imagine the good that your adversity would have brought out.
Oh, thank you for sharing that, and that very painful. And I'm so glad your son's okay and you're okay, and I'm sorry you went through that. That just sounds an absolute nightmare, and he was so young, but he's bouncing around now, and you've got 3 of them and you're still smiling. Bless you. Gosh, isn't that awful you lost your smile. So you do an awful lot for charity. You help with Upon Noon, helping women in midlife, the Good Grief Trust, helping bereavement, Her Spirit UK for a healthier, happier self, Roald Dahl with children, and Project Halo about COVID vaccine specialism. I mean, my goodness, do you ever get any time to yourself to do anything else?
I also work with Seek Forgiveness, which is a charity, a non-for-profit organisation set up for South Asians in the UK and around the world, talking in Punjabi and Urdu. So we do a podcast together.
Wow.
In Punjabi. I'm very aware that there are language barriers for people from the South Asian community.
Yes.
And I'm always advocating. So if there are healthcare professionals, if you have a skill, if you know something and you know that you speak a second language, please use that language to share. So I talk a lot about postnatal depression, grief, OCD, panic disorders, in Punjabi, so that people from my community understand the differences of these conditions, because unfortunately mental health is such a huge taboo, and we don't even actually have the words or it. So, you know, pagalpan is sometimes how they describe mental health, and that directly translated to English means madness, and that's not true.
No,
that's not a true accurate medical term. So I'm very careful as a doctor that when you're bilingual, that you try and convey the message through in a medical manner to say it's got nothing to do with madness. And the same with like menopause, for example, there's so many words that we don't have in our language. It took me a long while to realize that we don't have a proper word for menopause in our language. The word is in Urdu is banji. Banji means barren. That's not a translation of menopause.
Oh my goodness. No, they're very shocking words, aren't they? So
you're bridging
that gap and supporting so many people and making them feel heard and understood in that inclusive way. I think it's brilliant what you're doing. So do you have a mantra for living your life then, with all these amazing things you've been doing?
Yeah. I always say I can't swear on the podcast.
Oh, go on then. Only if it's in Punjabi.
No. Okay, I won't swear because that would be great. But no, I have two things. When it comes to making change, there's a great quote by Colleen Hoover that I've actually got on my wall, and I look at every now and then because sometimes I do get trolling, unfortunately, just because of, you know, I'm a woman of color, a Muslim woman. And if I say something that doesn't sit right with people, they don't agree with me, then the first thing they pick on is not my medical content, it's how I look. And I'm not exactly, you know, a stunning beauty either.
No,
I'm not looking for compliments. No, but it's true, because how often do you see a hijabed woman on telly? Very rarely. So I know that there are sort of people who still do get upset by that, and that's their problem. But Colleen Hoover wrote about cycles, and she wrote that when it comes to women, and this is so apt for this podcast, I think, because it's influential women, is that we put up with cycles. So she wrote that my mother went through this, all the cycles of pain. I am going through this, and I'll be damned if my daughter goes through this. And I think that is my mantra. I'll be damned if I don't have a daughter. I wish I did have a daughter, but I'll be damned if other daughters are going through the cycles of pain that we have hung up as women. So my hope always is that for the future generation, for the future girls, that things aren't taboo, talking about women's health aren't taboo. The other mantra that I have for myself that I always use every now and then is, so particularly if I'm like about to go live on This Morning or live on BBC Breakfast, I always say to myself, deep breath, you fucking got this.
Exactly. And box breathing, and you have, and look, and you're such a good and kind person looking out for everyone in the world. There should be more people like you lighting a candle for others. So what's your next goal then? More broadcasting, more influencing?
Do you know what? The term influencer doesn't sit right with me just yet. I have a massive imposter syndrome, but I think a lot of women do when they are so good at something. So they always say that the thing I'm really bad at, and I know I'm always chasing future Nagat. So I'm always thinking, I'm not amazing yet. In my head, future Nagat is like this incredible person, and I'm just not her yet. I think that the things that I would like to really focus on are the causes that are dear to my heart. Like, so the Roald Dahl Children Charity, really becoming an advocate for women's health in an inclusive manner. So I presented a lot of our feedback about women's health as a clinician at the select committee at the Houses of Parliament, which I'm really hoping will drive a huge change at how we deliver across the country. And we're global trendsetters, because Houses of Parliament are really looking into how menopause can be treated better for women in work care, GPs getting better training, testosterone being able to be available for women on the NHS, which it isn't available at the minute. Wow. and how training can be far better for women. And I'm so proud that I'm a tiny cog in that wheel to help that happen. Oh. And I think that it's not about fame, becoming a famous or an influential or followers, weirdly enough, for me is that I'd be very happy that if there was a little girl, 9-year-old Nagat, that just says, there was a woman that came, she did a tiny little change, and she was awesome. And that would make me so happy.
Oh, I'm sure there's loads of women out there and young women looking at you and thinking they want to be like you, to do what you're doing. And, you know, you've taught so many, you've given back so much, and after everything you've been through, and you're still helping and healing so many people. Thank you so much for sharing. Lastly, what key message would you give? We have men listening as well, actually, to our influential women. What message would you give to inspire and influence women or men to help their lives as we eventually re-emerge post-lockdown? You'll probably know better than we will because of your COVID specialism as a helpline. What can we do to help them from here on?
So I think that for men and women listening, challenge yourself in the tiniest little ways that you can. The pandemic, as we know, is a global pandemic. And unfortunately, from our previous knowledge of previous pandemics, like the Spanish flu and the plague, that they can last between, you know, 3 to 5 years. And so we're year two at the minute, but we have a vaccine, which we didn't have in previous pandemics. So we're constantly learning. And I think that's the thing. Use those opportunities to constantly learn and better yourself and self-educate yourself. And ask questions. I think this is the other thing that we're always so scared about. asking questions. If there is something that you don't know, I always constantly ask, even now, what is this? What does this mean? Where are we going? What's happening? To the point where I probably annoy people. And there are no silly questions to ever ask. I don't know how the future will hold, but I always focus on the good things that have come out of the pandemic. And there is so much good that's come out of it that actually when I focus on that, it shows me that we've got a brighter future ahead.
Oh, thank you so much for that. There have been good things. Communities have united. People have talked to their neighbours more, shown their loved ones they care more, done things that they've never done before, learned things they've never done before. And technology has united everyone around the world, hasn't it? It's incredible. And we're all still battling on, but looking for a brighter future. Thank you so much for your time. As described perfectly online, Dr. Nigat is an expert GP. Whilst remaining authentic to her values as a British Pakistani Muslim woman and mother, navigating and uniting the different cultures in a positive way, she has integrity, substance, humanity and style, and approaches life with humour. And thank you for your smile and for lighting the candle for so many others. Thank you for sharing your amazing life's work. It's been lovely to chat today, for uplifting us, making us feel safer in this crazy world and less anxious, and finding joy in the madness. This influential women's podcast is founded, hosted and exec produced by Nikki Bannerman, with edits by assistant producer Dulce Godfrey. Please review and share the ideas and thoughts on social channels, and check out our messages and branded t-shirts on our website, www.theinfluentialwomenpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Please keep listening for more back catalogue episodes and other amazing influential women. Thank you so much for your time today. Good luck with everything. Lovely to talk to you.